Actually, I haven't looked at the rules lately, but used to be 48 hours you had to notify them if it wasn't going to be repaired within the 48 hours. Same thing with the power lights. I think I've got 24 hours to notify the FAA. And then they spit out a NOTAM and all that stuff. And then it's only good for 12 days, and automatically it rescinds itself. And if you're still out of business, you got to call them up and renew the whole thing.
You did say 48 hours. If you have good reason to believe that your transmitter that's completely off the air is going to be repaired in 42 hours, not 48, does that mean no notice to the FCC is required of you, Eric?
Yeah, they expect it. You're going to have problems as long as it's not extended. It might be 24 hours. I have to look it up again. It's something that I don't keep in the back of my mind, but you get a reasonable period of time before you have to notify them.
Yeah, that's a question for the chief engineer of a broadcast station. We'll have to ask him that one of these days, next time we see him. Now, let's see. I'm having some fun with him. So, Joe, as I see it, I hope your house has an electric appliance, dryer, oven, range. If not, for you to create enough of a load to create a given number of watt hours. I am guessing your watt hour meter outside the house is digitized to the nearest 1 watt hour. If it had another dial there that went to a tenth of a watt hour, that would be nice, but I don't think they go that fine. So it's either 1 or 10 watt hours is the least significant bit on their machine. So creating that much of a load for that number of hours.
The meters, if you read them software-wise, they read in tenths of a kilowatt hour.
That's if you read them software-wise, but if you're reading the front panel, I'll be amazed if they go be what? I think you're saying it's 1 watt hour on the front panel?
If you happen to have the type of meter that you use with the solar panels, yeah, you get 1 watt. If you've got the conventional ones where you're not doing the solar panel, I think it's 10 watts.
If that's true, then just to hit that one digit, and you don't know whether or not you're halfway into that digit when you start making the measurement. If it was 10 and you got to create 10 kilowatt hours of drain, that many kilowatts for that many hours, so to speak, that's a pain. I wouldn't want to try to build a dummy load to do that. So K2LYY, I hope you got some electric appliances in your house, Steve, Joe. K2LYW, you got a Joe.
Well, sure I do. But then I have to rely on an old amp probe, and I don't know how accurate that amp probe is as far as me determining actual current draw on each leg to ground. If I was going to use that, that's part of the problem. I don't have you have to have an accurate way of measuring current to know that your load is going to be drawing a certain amount of kilowatts in 1 hour's amount of time. So they're always part of the problem. I have a fluke that can measure the voltage on each leg to ground or across it, and that seems to be fairly accurate, but the only thing I have is an old amp meter, amp probe. One of the Simpson, I think, makes an old clamp on one, but it's got to be about 30-something years old, maybe more. So I don't know how accurate it is anymore. It does read, and it does have those different scales on it, but I don't know. That's where some of the problem is, I guess. My instrumentation might be off. I might be, blaming the meter for being fast or slow, where my own instrumentation could be a problem if I tried to do it that way.
By the way, I just looked up an electric power meter, like the electro power meter. It reads in tenths of a kilowatt hour.
But it doesn't do that on the front panel, does it, Eric?
Again?
Does it have that amount of resolution on the front panel that your eye can see?
Yes, it does.
Very nice. Does someone else have a comment on this one?
Yeah, Dick, KD2HUC. It's probably not practical to try and set up a dummy load because, A, you're wasting all that energy. B, while you're trying to calculate what the meter's saying, you have to have everything else in the house off. It's kind of a pain. They make a lot of commercial products now available for power monitoring for residential panels and whatnot. They come with the snap-on CTs. You wire them up to a breaker for the voltage, and they hook right up to your wireless network. They they connect to your smartphone so you can monitor and whatnot. And they're relatively inexpensive. Most of them, the packages are less than $300, depending upon how crazy you want to go with it. But then you can monitor it in real time all the time. KD2, HUC, back to net.
Steve, I'm kind of curious. How come you use 975-375 as opposed to 2585 when you're transmitting from your home QTH? Over to you, Steve.
Well, that's a question for Eric, because I can't read the 85 machine until about 9:30. All of a sudden, whatever changes, the static goes away and the 850 machine comes in loud and clear. But right now it's loaded with static, and I cannot, comprehend anything that comes in on it. So that's why I go into the Selden machine.
Where is he located?
He's in Comac.
No, the question is how far north, because Jane Hill does a really nasty job. Once you go into Huntington here, it's like the machine can't hear you at all. Even my remote receiver mounted right here doesn't hear anybody. So if you're down by the expressway and you go south of that, then it gets better.
Yeah, where are you with reference to Jericho, for instance, Steve? Go ahead. How far north and south?
I'm about a block south. And I doubt very highly that location has anything to do with it, because like I said, about 9:30 or so, whatever's causing the interference goes away, and my QTH isn't moving, and neither is the repeater, so there's got to be something else at play. KD2HUC, back to net.
You've got the problem that Joe had. Let me drop. Steve, it's time for you to do some sniffing. By way of a handy talkie or any other kind of a portable radio that operates on, let's say, 2 meters, particularly if one has a AM or sideband capability, you walk around your community when that noise is there. And I think you're going to find within a block of your house something is making an awful lot of noise, like arcing contacts of a pool heater or a fish tank heater or something like that. For Eric to change his effective isotropic radiated power in exactly your azimuth from his direction, and to do it at 8 o'clock at night, I think that's essentially out of the question. Let me go over to Eric first for a confirmation on this. KE2EJ, K2IW, go ahead, Eric. Maybe, I think there's a slim possibility that some kind of a switching takes place with your voting system, but I kind of doubt it. KE2EJ, K2IW.
Now, are you talking about receiving it, which has nothing to do with the voting system? There are places where there's impulse noise that winds up for showing up. Actually, an AM radio might be the better device to go sniffing for. The output of the repeater's pattern does have some scalloping in it, but because of the geography, the amount of signal there is much less than, say, you go 4 or 5 miles south. So that's just the nature of the pattern itself. There's a little scalloping, and there's a little bit of a null headed towards the north, but it's just one of those things that we've never really been able to do too much about, except for in the past when the antenna was mounted on the side of the building, whereas we got better coverage in that area, but worse coverage in some other areas. So don't forget, this antenna is in the middle of a whole bunch of things, the metal pipes and a lot of other antennas. So the concept of the pattern was done very seat of the pants, so to speak, with a spectrum analyzer and a reference antenna, which isn't necessarily the most accurate way to do it. The way we do it with broadcast antennas is we usually fly a helicopter around it, and that's not going to happen to this, so KTYWK2J.
Did you say the antenna did move?
Yeah, but that was a couple of years ago. Eric, a modern-day man today gets out his drogue helicopter system, installs some kind of a field strength meter on it and flies it any where he wants to make an antenna pattern measurement. So nowadays, it can be done for hobby-type prices, I think, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, interestingly enough, when they put the temporary antennas on the World Trade Center, oh, and by the way, you can get NBC now on 36, which is the 36 or 35, I forget. It's the same one as NJU is on, which is what you call Channel 41. They're also transmitting the same thing as your Channel 28, so you might try that in terms of trying to get NBC. That'll help you out a lot. But what they did is they had a truck with a mast and a Tektronix signal analyzer and a bunch of other stuff to do some recording. And they drove around circularly in many different places and tried to see what the pattern was, and they kept going outwards and outwards. So they didn't do the helicopter bit, which is probably going to happen sometime in this coming summer because more and more stuff is going up there. Actually, we should be on the air from World Trade, I think, by the middle of December. Actually, tomorrow, I'm going to be pointing this dish that I just put up, looking at World Trade, and let's see if we can light that up. K2RIW, K2J.
That sounds like a fun operation. You shouldn't insist they pay you for that job, Eric. There's so much fun involved with it. I do notice that NBC, which over-the-air broadcast tells us that it's Channel 4, now has 4-1, 4-2, 4-3, and 4-4. For the time being, 4-1 and 4-3 are identical, 4-2 and 4-4 are identical, but I'll bet that's going to change. And is that now coming from World Trade, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, if you look at the signal strength, you'll see that the one coming from World Trade is a lot better than the one coming from Empire. What's going to happen is probably, because they're still building their facility, I think they're probably going to stay on Empire until 2019. But they could at any point kill it because they're doing the same thing on 47. So NBC has their main channel and their sub channel, which is Cozy TV. And it's on both transmitters.
Now, you just said, if I listen to Empire or if I listen to World Trade, what do I do as an over-the-air broadcast viewer? What do I do to select whether or not I'm listening to NBC from World Trade or NBC from Empire? Over to you, Eric.
Well, depends on your receiver. Some receivers will let you dial up the RF frequency and it will then automatically display 4-dash or whatever. Or you can rescan your receiver and hope it's got decent software that it doesn't get confused that there's two RFs with the same major channel number.
My crazy Vizio set does something strange. If a new channel occurs at a channel number, advertised number, in between the two that I did in the last scan, when I go from, let me give you an example. Channel 25 is at one spot on the dial. Channel 31 is another spot on the dial, so to speak. Channel 29 from Philadelphia came along. And one day when I tried to go from 25 to 31, I didn't do a rescan. It found 29, and I found four stations from Philadelphia suddenly in there. Well, that episode has occurred a few times. So if in between the advertised numbers, somebody has established a new channel, my Vizio seems to automatically find it. And if that the channel goes away, in other words, the band opening is not there, 29 from Philadelphia is not there all the time. If it goes away for, let me pick a number, 10 consecutive days, it seems to remove it automatically. That's a crazy function I never knew was there. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RW, K2J. Well, you have a more recent receiver. If you don't have your converter box, you'll find your converter box doesn't do that. That converter box probably has to be scanned in order to find new stuff. And some of them, some of the older ones, you dial in the RF number and it doesn't know what you're talking about. So, depends on the software and the receiver. Actually, I don't think I've run into that. But, it makes sense because, you know, when in your off time, sometimes the receiver will scan and see what's out there and then all of a sudden add it to their table.
Dick, what you're getting is RF42 from Philadelphia, which is digital 29, because the RF42 in Bridgeport is no longer on the air. At least I haven't seen it on the air in a couple of weeks. That's why that's happening.
Yeah, that's good to know, Eric. Joe. And Eric, I've got a menu I can go to where I can add channels. I can tell it what channel number I want it to add. And I don't know whether or not it'll allow me to dial in the RF frequency as opposed to the advertised frequency, if you know what I mean. But there is a sub-menu I can go to where I can tell it to add new channels. So, once again now, tell me the RF frequency and or channel number that has recently been added. KE2EJ, K2RW.
K2RW, K2EJ. Again, it depends on the receiver and its software. You know, as time goes on, they get to improve their software like the LG receiver that I have here. It'll let me dial in the RF channel number and it'll tell me what the advertised or the virtual channel number is and whatever sub-channels are there. I mean, typically you look at channel 9 and you'll find out that you're actually dealing with two RF frequencies. Same thing with channel 5. Those virtual channels, you're dealing with two different RF frequencies.
Yeah, that I've discovered. 9-1 and 9-2 are coming from one location at one RF frequency. 9-3 and 9-4 are on another RF frequency, possibly from another location. Because I can lose 1 and 2 and have 3 and 4 and vice versa. The dash numbers, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, they're coming from the same location, but they're coming off of two different antennas.
Oh-ho! That sort of explains it. Now, there's a new channel that was recently added of NBC, I think you told me. Try to tell me an RF frequency or an advertised frequency, Eric. Go ahead.
Give me a second. I can tell you what the RF and advertised frequency is. Not in the top of my head at the moment.
Probably RF 36.
Okay, Joe, RF 36, it calls itself what frequency? What channel number?
Channel 47 WNJU. They're on RF 36. I don't have any sub-channels at all because I haven't locked that. I don't watch stuff on that. But that's probably what he's talking about because I think that's owned by NBC.
Now, 47, I've been watching 47 for a long period of time. It's a Spanish channel. 47-1 is purely Spanish. 47-2, the material is Spanish, but the program guide is always in English. Interesting combination. But 47 can't be new, because I've been watching it for a year. Now back to you on that one, Joe.
RF-36 will show up as DTV 4-3 for NBC.
Okay, I now see a 4-3 and a 4-4. Where I used to have 4-1, 2, and 3, I've now got 1, 2, 3, and 4. So it appears to me that 4 was added, but I guess you're saying 3 was really squeezed in between?
4-3 and 4-4 are coming from World Trade. What you used to get on 4-3 disappeared, I think, about 6 months ago. Because they used to have two sub-channels, but they cut it back to one. So you probably have the 4-3 as a leftover from the last time you stored the channels in your set.
Okay. I think you're saying that when I go to 4-3, because of previous programming, it might not be going to the new RF frequency. Is that what you're saying, Eric? So the possibility exists that 4-1 and 2 are from Empire and 4-3 and 4 are from World Trade, something like that. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, that's exactly right. 4-1 and 4-2 on RF-28, 4-3 and 4-4 on RF-36. And if you go back 6 months or a year, there used to be 4-1, 4-2, and 4-3 from Empire. But the 4-3 disappeared quite a while ago. And if you had recently tuned to a 4-3 before they started transmitting from World Trade, you probably just got a duplication of 4-2.
Yeah, the one thing I don't like about this Vizio set is I can't tell it to tell me. I can't order it to tell me what RF frequency it's on. It only gives me channel numbers. So if, for instance,
when you go into setup.
Yeah, I don't know if I can force it to tell me the RF frequency. But maybe you're right. I'll have to check on that in setup. In setup is where it does scanning. You're telling me there's a subroutine in setup where I can force it to tell me the RF frequency? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Depends upon the manufacturer. Like, for this one, I go into setup, I go into manual tune, I dial in the RF frequency, and it will tell me what the virtual channel numbers are.
Dick has this sound for a suggestion. Don't you have a converter you used to run off the air for, you know, television reception? Why don't you use that with a splitter and have one lead go to your Vizio and one lead go to the converter? And then take the output of the converter, which is probably video out, and left and right audio, and feed that to an input of your Vizio. So you can still use your Vizio, but you're using a converter as a tuner. And that way you have your availability of seeing an RF frequency if you want to do, like, DXing, for example, or explore the band.
Yeah, that's my old Radio Shack converter, set-top converter, and it only displays 525 lines, but it is a way of doing that. I'd consider that. I should set that up. There's also something funny going on with this Vizio in that I can be somewhere on the dial, and I tell it to go to 2-2, and I go there, and it finds a 2-2 that's very weak. If I go to 2-1 and tell it to go up one, it finds the real 2-2 that's strong. I haven't found out what the hell is going on that one. Got to guess what's happening on that one, Eric, K2EJ, K2IW.
I'll tell you what's going on. You're seeing RF-22 from Ridge, which is duplicate of CBS New York. That's all you're seeing.
Right. So in other words, if I tell it to go directly to 2-2, it's saying it's going to the RF frequency of Ridge. If I'm on 2-1 and I tell it to go up one, then it finds the real 2-2 is what I think you guys are saying. Go ahead.
No. My converter has, I can display the RF frequency. If I go to 2-2 and if I look the RF channel, I'll find it on RF-22 and I'll also find it on RF-33. Same thing with 2-1. So if you go from 2-1 up to 2-1, it's just going from RF-22 to RF-33. Then the first 2-2 you come to is going back to RF-22, and the second one's coming off RF-33. You're getting off the back of your antenna. That's why it's weak. Get a rotor, Dick. Get a rotor, Dick.
Yeah, let me tell you what's going on there.
WS2N.
Yeah, Eric, first, never go to a pole, not order. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay, in the piece of table that's in this set, right, you're going to have two entries for 2-2. One which is on channel 33, and one that's on, I think it's 22, which is WLNY, actually. Since CBS bought LNY quite a number of years ago, you'll notice that at 9 o'clock, they do the news, which is the same folks that do the news on Channel 2. It's coming out of the same studio. When you go up by using the up channel, the receiver's already locked onto 33. So what it's doing now is it's looking at its table, and it sees 2-2, and it just changes what stream you're looking at. When you dial directly, Then it's looking in the table, it's looking straight for 2-2, and it finds the 2-2 at the lower RF frequency, and it grabs that one.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Eric. Now go ahead, Paul, WS2N, K2RAW.
You're talking about channel 2. Strange thing happens with my boxes. I have 3 converter boxes hooked up to 3 different sets. One of them works fine, you know, I scanned it, work, you know, channel 2 comes out, if I hit 2, channel 2 will come up, 2-2 will also come up. But the other two boxes, if you just hit 2 like you want to go to channel 2, nothing happens. It doesn't recognize that you have it in there. But if you hit 22, you hit 2-2 real quick, the station will come up. You know, channel 2 will come up, and then if you want to go to, you know, 2-1, then you just hit the up button, and you can go up, and you're good to go. But just to get to the channel 2, you have to hit 22 real quick. That's a strange effect. And on both boxes, 2 different brands. Back to you, Dick.
So you're down to your last 3 converter boxes, and with some of them, you can put in an RF frequency. My old Radio Shack, I could tell her what RF frequency I wanted to go to. And I could also tell it what the advertised channel I wanted to go to. The Vizio might have that with subroutines, but I haven't looked deep enough yet to get that. Almost all of my television watching is over-the-air broadcast. Paul, are you the other guy? I think there's one other human being on Long Island in Suffolk County that's watching over-the-air broadcast and not using cable or satellite TV. Are you that other guy, Paul? That's S2N, K2RIW.
Only about 5% of the time or if the cable goes out. So after that Hurricane Sandy, that was it. I went crazy with these boxes and with the outdoor antenna. The only thing I didn't do is I should have put a rotor on that antenna. I haven't done that yet. But now I understand you can get an inexpensive rotor, like for $28 on the internet. And an inexpensive rotor with an antenna as well, you know, all in one set. That sounds good. So maybe I'll do that one of these days. Yeah, it's the prices have come way down. You can't get it in the store, but you can send away for it.
Out of curiosity, GS. Roy, recognize. Get you in a second. This antenna that comes with an antenna plus rotator. The antenna itself is just a simple. Flat plate with some dipoles on it, or is it a real Yagi-like thing? The actual antenna that's on that rotator, what does it look like, Eric? I mean, here we go. Paul, WS2N, K2IW.
I haven't seen it in person yet. Give me about a month and I'll see it. I know somebody got one, so I'll look at it. I'll bring it up on the internet. I forgot the name of it, and then I can get better idea of what it is. It might have an amplifier in there too, some kind of a pre-amplifier. I'll have to. He's not sure about that. I'll have to look.
Now, AC2GS, Roy, you're down to your last 3 computers monitoring Echo Link and Chat Room and IRLP and everything else. On top of that, when it comes to your television reception in Brooklyn, if I know you, you've got the cable TV, satellite TV, and occasionally you dabble with over-the-air. AC2GS, K2RIW, good, Roy.
Well, actually, most of my stuff I get through my internet connection. I have some satellite dish feeds, but overwhelmingly I get it through the internet. But the primary reason for me to break in was someone in the chat room had a comment and I just wanted to relay it. WA2SVM asked the LI group to try and tune DTV RF channel 23 WFTY from Middle Island, New York, was his comment.
Yeah, that's a question for Joe and Paul. Joe, I bet you've seen that one often. Is that true, Joe? W-A-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-I-W.
Yeah, Yeah, I forget the call letters. I think it's RF23 is Digital 67 for Middle Island, and they're on a very tall tower. I think they're about 800 feet above sea level atop the tower. So that's where that is, and they run, I think, four sub-channels, 67, 1, 2, 3, and 4, maybe 5 now, because I think 68, which is out of the city, it's just like a duplication of them, just added an additional sub-channel, so there's actually 5 sub-channels you can get now instead of 4, but that's where RF-23 is. But there's also an RF-23 somewhere around Camden, New Jersey, I think. Because sometimes the band opens up, if I put my converter on RF-23, I can see Middle Island off the back of my antenna and get it quite strong, but sometimes I don't get it. It gets broken up. So there's got to be, you know, interference with this other station. Sometimes I have pointed the antenna at the location in Middle Island. I mean, not Middle Island, in Jersey, and I have got the other station, but the band has to be very, very strong for me to get it, because I got something off the back of my antenna on the same frequency.
For about 10 years, I used to live in Middle Island, and that tower you're talking about, which is one block north of Jericho Turnpike on top of a hill in Middle Island, that tower is 550 feet high. It's on what I think is roughly 250-foot land, so that makes it very close to 800 feet above sea level. And I think it's a Rhone 85, or it's a Rhone 90 tower. I think that tower is triangular and 45 or 48 inches face size. Really massive tower. If you go to the right Google Earth view, you get some beautiful pictures of that tower. the shadow it casts on the ground is really huge. The top-down picture of it is confusing at first, if you know what I mean. So, that's a potent one. Any further comments you think required on that, Roy, AC2GS, K2LAW?
Well, by the way, Channel 58 that comes out of New Jersey is actually Channel 8.
How about that? I don't get 8, but I do get 67, very strong, 68, very strong, and 67, I think it's got 5 sub-channels these days. 67, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. AC2GS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, I just wanted to add WA2SVM had another comment. He said he has 5 channels on that RF channel with Justice TV. But you know, for some odd reason, broadcast TV, I kind of let it go because I don't like to particularly watch commercials anyway. So the internet is a wonderful source of information. You know, I always say Google is our friend, but the internet in general is an incredible source for all this stuff.
Now, you didn't give me that call letter phonetically. It sounded like Whiskey 2 Sierra Bravo Mike, but that doesn't make sense when I look him up. Give me those call letters phonetically, Roy.
It's Whiskey Alpha 2 Sierra Victor Mike.
Okay, stand by. Okay, he's in Glen Ridge, New Jersey. How about that, David? By way of his picture, he's a pretty serious guy, I can tell. So, Sierra Victor Mike, yeah, he signed into the TechNet on a number of occasions. So, in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, I guess with a little bit of a band opening, or just if he's got a good location, he's getting that Middle Island station at 800 feet above sea level, is what I think you're saying. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, he says he makes the repeater, repeater is also on the tower, comes in good in New Jersey, so he's picking us up good. I guess he can't transmit, but he's picking us up.
He has signed into the TechNet on occasion, but I guess it's a propagation thing. I'll have to take a quick look and see how many miles he is from my QTH. According to this chart, he's 45 miles airline from me. So he must be 65 miles from that broadcast station, because that's due east of me, almost 20 miles. but I get it very well, but because I'm in its backyard, even though it's off the back of my antenna. Okay, let's see. Joe, did we answer all your questions? I'm not even quite sure what your original question was, but let's make sure we've almost answered. Oh, yes. When it comes to a hot power appliance in your house, let me drop. When it comes to turning off everything in your house, you are the power czar of your house. So turning off everything to make sure you're not getting a false alarm reading, for you that's relatively easy. And if you then putting on a heavy load that is a 230-volt appliance that is going from line to line that doesn't even have to go to ground. So just making a measurement of one of those lines is all you need to do. And when it comes to your clamp-on ammeter, you've done enough calibrating in your days. I'm relatively sure that within a 5% accuracy, you could calibrate your clamp-on ammeter if you were at all suspicious of its accuracy. Guarantee you could choose some appliance in the house, clamp onto that wire, and check on your ammeter. So it's a bit of a bootstrapping operation, calibrating your meter, which then calibrates the meter outside the house. But I think you've got the technology to do that, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I don't really have the means to do that because I have no way of reading the amperage with something else to compare the first meter to know if it's reading accurately. The only other thing I have that reads AC amperage is the Fluke, but it only got up to 10 amps, so I'm not going to, break a wire open on the sub panel and try to meter that way. If I go over, it'll blow the internal fuse, so I'm not going to really try to do that. I have no other way of measuring AC current, so you're wrong on that one.
If you took that AC clamp-on ammeter that you own and you walk over to Andy's house, W2CDL, after calling him on the phone first, he's down to his last two or three clamp-on ammeters. Some of them true RMS, some of them are ordinary. So you could compare the reading at his QTH of your meter versus two or three of his. So with some difficulty, you could calibrate yours. And the chances, on the assumption you haven't thrown it down up a flight of stairs and shipped the case, the chances of your clamp-on ammeter going more than 5% out of accuracy, I think, are relatively low. Over to you on that one, Joe. K2LIW.
Well, I don't throw my instruments down the stairs. And as far as checking against somebody else's instrumentation, I don't have the means to do that anymore. So that's that. It's not something within my house I can use to check it. I guess I can't check it.
You're saying you can't transport your meter over to Andy's house to compare it to his three meters. You're saying you can't get to Andy's house, even if I drove you there. Go ahead.
Well, yes, but that's okay. You know what? I was looking for a simpler answer to be able to check it, but I guess I'll have to think about something else. I have nothing else to compare it to, so it's going to be kind of tough unless I put a certain known resistance across a certain leg that I knew would draw so much current. I could probably check it that way, but then I have to combine some enough resistor or resistance to make up some sort of load to be able to check the current through this meter to make sure it's reading accurately or fairly accurate. That's the only thing I could possibly do. I have resistor networks constructed for reading like outputs of audio amplifiers up to 100 watts, so I could probably use something like that and maybe get an idea how much amperage it's supposed to draw through using one of those kind of loads, possibly. That's another possibility. I'll think of something, but I thought there was an easy way to do it, but apparently it's not going to be that easy. I got to have an accurate way of measuring the amperage being drawn to know how much power is being drawn through the meter to know whether it's accurate or not. And I'm not going to go out and buy one of these power misers or whatever to read current whatever for $300. I'm not going to do that. I'm like you. If you don't have to spend money, you don't.
I'm a member of the Freeloading Society. For free, take it, for buy, waste time. that's an old-fashioned set of jokes from way back when, before you guys were born. You didn't even hear about that. You don't even know about interlocutors and vaudeville shows. Alrighty, I think we've gone through the list of people who signed in who didn't have questions or comments. Now we're going to go over to the newer section of the TechNet, which we're thinking of calling it Physics Talk or Physic Talk. And the chairman of that, who collects information from both the mailbag and from my chat room and bird droppings, is Roy. And so, Roy, I think you've got a physics subject to discuss tonight. So, AC2GS, K2RIW, you got it, Roy.
Yes, AC2GS here, and thank you, Dick. We got two questions from the chat room. The first question was towards the end of last week's TechNet that I saved for today. The other one appears to have popped up about 3 days ago. Someone visited the chat room by himself, left a message, and moved on. But both of them are physics, so we're good for physics questions, if nothing else.
Fire away, because we're in the mood for physics, and I'm getting some very good feedback from the physics subjects we discussed. Well, we discussed over-the-air television broadcast and radio towers and the World Trade Center and all kinds of things like that, which is some physics. And I've got a physics question that will blow your mind if the ones that Roy has are not deep enough for you. But I think Roy's are deep enough. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, the first question states, how did Galileo discover that the Earth traveled around the sun? What was it that he saw or realized? And, you know, I can wax poetic about the history of heliocentrism and geocentrism, but that's the question that the gentleman presents.
Do we have a volunteer who's going to give us an answer on that one? Give me your call letters right now and name, K2RIW.
WS2N.
There's a spaceman from way back. So Paul's the first on the list. Is there anyone else? Looks like it might be only you, Paul. So what did Galileo do? And how much trouble did he get in by doing it? What did he do to find out does the Earth go around the sun? Is the Earth the center of the whole mankind's universe? You've got it, Paul. Here we go, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
He did wind up in a lot of trouble. I think quite a few years in house arrest. So he did stick his neck out. But as far as I remember, because he had the telescope, and he was looking at the planets going around Jupiter, he realized, look at these planets. These aren't stars out there. They're little moons going around Jupiter, Io, Calypso, Ganymede, Europa, you know, the four Galileo moons. So he realized that if that's happening there, that's what's probably happening with the Earth and all the other planets. We're going around the sun. At one time, they used to think that no matter what it was, you know, there wasn't anything going around something else. You know, everything was revolving around the Earth, and this changed that whole belief system. I think that's it. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to pass it turned over to Roy, because Roy has an alternate explanation, which might be equally as valid. But yes, those Galileo moons, the four strongest brightness moons around Jupiter, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. Because the first person who seems to have really recognized them, the first person who seemed to have really looked at them with a telescope, was good old Galileo Galilei, I think is his name, Mr. Galileo. And the strange thing is that when he published this information and propagated that information, the Catholic Church didn't want to believe it. It was completely different from their doctrine. The fact that he could see it with his own telescope, with his own eyes, did not sway them at all. They wanted to believe that what was the image being presented in that telescope was a lie. Let me drop it.
Galileo first see the phases of Venus.
That's what Roy's going to tell us. I'm going to turn it over to Roy. So, Roy, maybe Venus came first and the moons of Jupiter came second? AC2GS to straighten this all out, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, do you want just the answer, or do you want a little preliminary spiel to this all?
The choice is yours. This is your show, Roy.
Okay, AC2GS. The point is that early civilization was very strange. They tended to think of the world, of the universe, as a kind of a domed snow globe, basically flat Earth and a dome around with these bright objects moving around every which way. And then they kind of decided everything had to be perfect. Everything had to go in circular motions, and since we were obviously standing still, everything was moving around us in perfect circles. But even the Babylonians realized the sun wasn't traveling in a perfect circle around us. So there's a big question of it was geocentrism is what they called it. The Earth was the center of the universe because as far as everyone was concerned, we weren't moving any place. We were quite stable. Then there was heliocentrism, which was not very popular. There was one Greek philosopher who wasn't a popular one who believed in it, but the problem is guys like Aristotle and Plato really loved this theory. Let me let it drop. I mean, Aristotle had this whole thing about the four elements of earth, water, air, fire, and he also had a fifth, ether. And supposedly the ether rose above all the other elements and created the celestial spheres. And inside the celestial spheres were these objects that they pretty much all called stars, except, you know, some of the stars, like the sun and the moon, went on a regular path, but there were these erratic things that just wandered all over the place. And the Greek for wandering star is a planet, and that's how planets got their name. So that was Aristotle. And about a couple hundred years later, Ptolemy decided that these celestial spheres were nonsense, but what was going on was each of these wandering planets were just spiraling around some invisible axis and going at perfect circles then around the Earth. Let me let it drop.
Were those called epicycles? And what was the epicycle circling around? Go ahead, Deborah.
Yes, exactly. It was circular orbits, but within the circular orbits were these epicenters that sort of looked like if you took a spring and stretched it out, you know, a helical kind of pathway. That was how they explained these erratic, bizarre motions that the wandering planets had, although that still didn't really solve the problem. Then came Nicholas Copernicus, who wrote that great book that said on the revolution of celestial spheres, which changed the whole meaning of the word revolution. Revolution just means something going around and around. But once he wrote that book, it was so, quote, revolutionary, end quote, that it made up that other meaning for the word. Copernicus also did economic theory and actually invented Gresham's theory, if you know that bad money drives out good. But nevertheless, Nicholas Copernicus looked up at the sky and said, this makes no sense, guys. It's really complicated if we make the Earth the center. I think we should make the sun the center. And that's what he published, and everyone got very angry and upset and yelled and screamed and jumped around. Let me have a drop for a sec. Okay, now you got this guy Tycho Brahe, which was a nobleman, who his claim to fame, among other things, is he lost his nose in a duel and walked around with a metal nose for most of his life. And he made these calculations and wrote them down about the movement of the celestial objects, and he had his own weird idea. He kind of had a halfway, one halfway the other. He thought that there were some planets that went around the sun and some things that went around the Earth. So he was kind of some guy in the middle. Then you had Galileo Galilei. And the first thing he did when he improved the telescope and looked was he did notice that the Venus had phases, which made no sense. The only way that the Venus phases made sense is if Venus was at some points between the sun and us, and other times on the other side of the sun. And if that makes no sense. If it's running at a circular path around the Earth, it should stay either behind the sun or in front of the sun. So that's really where he picked up the clue. Let me let it drop again. AC2GS. Anyway, the moons, the Galilean moons of Jupiter, were discovered by Galileo, but unfortunately they were discovered at the same exact time by a guy named Simon Marius. So he doesn't win any award for that. I think he thought they were stars, though, because he kept on wanting to name them stars. He wanted to name them Cosmos stars, and then he decided he wanted to call them Medician stars because those were the guys who paid his bills. But Simon Marius took a suggestion by Kepler himself and called it after the four goddesses who were the lovers of Zeus. Now, that gets us to Johannes Kepler, who's the guy who figured it out. You see, up until then, even though they had it right that it's going around the sun, it still didn't work out very well because it was always using perfect spheres. It was all going around in circles. And so Kepler was the guy who discovered that they were elliptical orbits, and that's his first law of planetary motion. Then you go to Isaac Newton, who actually wrote down and proved it through his theory of universal gravitation. But then you got a guy like Albert Einstein, who I guess wanted to have a little cheekiness, and he explained in his way that everything is relative. So it's all your frame of reference. If you want, you could make the sun the center of the universe, the Earth the center of the universe. Centauri Prime you could make, as long as you translate all the equations accordingly. It gets a lot more complicated to translate the equations if you don't put the sun in the center, but theoretically you can do it. So once again, Albert Einstein, it's all relative. And that's the story.
Anybody have any further questions or comments on what you've just heard? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW.
WS2N. So which guy gets the credit? That's what I want to know, Roy.
I'll bet you it's a lot of shared credit, is my guess. But maybe the jury's still out. Go ahead, Roy.
It's evolutionary. Success has many fathers. Failure is an orphan. You could say that the Galileo won because they're called the Galilean moons of Jupiter, but you could say that Simon Marius won as well because he got to name them Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. So I think they both got the blue ribbon, if you will.
Do they both get the blue ribbon for solar-centric solar system? Or that our solar system is solar-centric and not geocentric? Do both of them get credit for that concept, Roy?
I think, unfortunately, it's a bit of partial credit all over the damn place, because the theory itself predates something like 300 years B.C. I would personally say Nicholas Copernicus should get the award, because he's the guy who published and explained the concept. I mean, it's all well and good, guys, proving it out by doing practical experiments. But, the Higgs boson is named after Higgs, and he wasn't the guy in the Hadron Collider doing the experiments. He was the guy scribbling away with a pencil and a pen.
But you still had a fair amount of error until you really had the confirmable, provable mathematics of elliptical orbits. And I think that mathematics was Newton. So Newton's got to get some of the credit for making the math of a heliocentric solar system work. Is there any truth in that one, Roy? Go ahead.
Actually, I would give the credit to Johann Kepler, because he was the guy who realized, he scratched away and scratched away, and he realized that if he modified all these orbits from their perfect circles to elliptical orbits, things worked out very good. Again, that was his first law of planetary motion. Isaac Newton proved the reason why elliptical orbits worked due to gravity. So the underlying theory of the gravitational forces that were producing the elliptical orbits were made understandable by Isaac Newton. But Johannes Kepler, long before then, established elliptical orbits as the way of calculating it. And keep in mind that wasn't perfect either. There are some orbits, especially Mercury, which you have to actually use a bit of relativity to explain.
Yeah, as I remember, Einstein made a prediction that if you carefully track Mercury and you look at it blinking out a star behind Mercury or just tracking its orbit's precess. In other words, its orbit is elliptical. An elliptical orbit has got a major axis and a minor axis. Well, that major axis and that minor axis slowly rotates. That's called precession. And so I think it was Einstein who predicted that amount of precession. Or was he predicting the amount of change in the apparent position of a star behind the sun? Maybe he predicted both. Straighten me out on that one, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I believe it was precession. I don't know if they did any research into... changing stars is really problematic back in the 1920s and 30s. So it was the precession that apparently was the go-to proof. You know, I mean, the last 100 years have been an endless number of proofs proving Einstein. Up until very recently, the last one that I'm aware of are those wonderful gravitational waves that we're finding out so much with. So this guy just keeps on giving.
And if we have the time, I may talk about a gravity wave puzzle that I think I invented. I didn't invent the raw data. I just looked at the raw data and said, gee, this is unusual. So we might get to that tonight, and if not, it'll wait till next week. But there's a real mind blower on that very first gravitational wave detection by the LIGO pair of instruments. I'll give you a little bit of hint. Each of those two black holes that came together in 1955, I think it was in September, 2015. In the year 2015, the very first detection of LIGO took place, both in Hanford, Washington, and Louisiana, can't think of the name of the town in Louisiana. And these were a pair of roughly 30 solar mass black holes. Let me drop it. You got two solar mass black holes that for millions of years were orbiting each other as binaries and slowly getting closer and closer. And so in September 17th, I think it was, of 2015, they came together and gave this chirping sound on the LIGO machine. In roughly a third of a second, these two objects moved around each other at something close to 1,000 times per second. In the last half second of that event, these two objects went from a very small number to one-half the speed of light. They accelerated that fast as they came together, circling each other as a binary. So you take something as heavy as 30 solar masses. The sun is 2 times 10 to the 30 kilograms, really heavy. A third of a million times heavier than the Earth. So you take something that heavy, 30 times heavier as a black hole, a pair of them, and accelerate them in the last third of a second to one-half the speed of light. To take something that heavy and to accelerate it that fast. You can calculate the force if you want to. I did. It's something like 10 to the 40 newtons of force. Really big force. Where in the world did the raw energy come from to do that? Anybody got any comments on this one? Give me your call letters. K2RIW and AC2GS. We're listening. I'm going to turn it over to Roy if he wants to make some comments on this. And I jumped out of sequence. That was supposed to be the fourth puzzle. But as you can tell, I got excited. Maybe you want to go to your second one, Roy. AC2GS, K2LAW.
No, this is fine. We could stay here for a while, and then we'll see what happens. These questions don't kind of time out anyway. I mean, they're always appropriate. So I would say that it's not anything particularly special. Centripetal centrifugal